My name is Kirsten Wright. I'm finishing a PhD at Systems Design at the University of Waterloo. And we're here at a particular time in history, right? With El Nino on the horizon, we may cross 1.5 degrees this summer, which means we've missed the deadline in a real sense for preventing climate change. It means as a civilization, we run off a cliff, right? And our best hope is to find our way back and claw our way up that cliff, right? So it's a different discussion than we've been having for my whole lifetime, right? I was born, we knew about climate change and we're working on it in a way that whole time. And the tenor of that discussion is shifting. Right now, the number that keeps me up at night is every tenth of a degree that the climate warms, 140 million people are pushed out of their climate niche, right? And if we don't get back, that means never being able to go home again. So what does that mean in terms of a research agenda, right? And how, as engineers and physicists and mathematicians, we do our everyday research and find time to move towards shifting this. In COVID, a lot of us developed a practice of building models off the side of our desk. Right? And those models were what is happening on the physics, but also what does that mean socially? What are the dynamics and links you can tie into that? So I think that will be where they'll be. You'll hear from a number of different people that modeling, okay, what is happening in the climate system? And what does that mean? How does that interact with the decisions and the pathways that can get us to something different? In particular, I'm particularly passionate about the co-benefits, right? If we're talking about an investment of at least 10 to 15% of GDP. That's not government money. That's GDP investment. That's not growth. That's a one-shot investment in building a better world, right? It's a massive public investment, which should have a massive public return, right? So who do the returns go to? And like, what do people own? What is the resilient stack in terms of hardened infrastructure that builds around individuals and communities and societies? I work in particular on development projects. So building missing middle housing type projects with Dawn, and then more recently on hardened infrastructure and currencies, green currencies, that the actual economic structures you can model, how would they shift, right? And how can they be directly put in service of addressing climate change? I'm before the gong.
Thank you very much, Kirsten. I'll just jump in very briefly. Well, thank you very much. That's exactly what we kind of want to hear. Just a bit of motivation, what you work on. Thank you. One thing I forgot to say, could we have 4 volunteers for the later sessions to go join Kirsten and give her feedback? 4 volunteers, because afterwards we'll be having these group discussions. 4 people, Adrian, okay. Amireza, 2 other people, okay. 1 more person, perfect. Okay, next up, who do we have? Four more volunteers, just so we can give very direct feedback afterwards in the group discussions. Okay, Hanin. Okay, 2 more. Christopher, Kirsten, lovely. Here we go.
Hi, everyone. My name is Vasundhara Sarvade. I'm also finishing my PhD at the School of Environment, Enterprise and Development at Waterloo. So my research is behind looking at the financing behind these climate development projects, you know, anything that ranges from infrastructure to, building new waterways or building LRTs and things like that. So it's very much linked to the financing behind, how climate adaptation and mitigation happens. So I focus on the green bonds market, which is a sustainable finance instrument. So a green bond is just like a regular bond, but it looks at financing the environmental impacts and creating benefits from these projects. So why is that important? It's important because we need about $3.8 trillion in annual investments through 2025. But there's a big gap right now in terms of how much money is actually being spent. a big portion of the financing right now comes from green bonds. So that's why this market is so interesting. It's also another way to get investors excited about green financing and financing climate change mitigation and adaptation. So it's another way of getting people interested in climate change and reducing its impacts. So as of 2023, green bonds have raised $2.3 trillion, which is a lot of money in terms of sustainable finance. So it's interesting to understand where the investor psychology and the mindset comes from. And that's where my research fits in. So basically, I'm looking at investor behavior and the investor psychology around these investments, as well as improving public policy. What can public policymakers do in terms of, you know, targeting interventions or creating incentives for these investors to push more money into it? And then finally, looking at, you know, what sort of economic interventions can be introduced and how can we transition the brown investment that we have. So things, you know, think about like oil sands or any sort of, you know, carbon intensive investments. How can we move that money towards more climate resilient and more, you know, green and green friendly investments right now? So I'm looking at the investor surveys. How are we doing in terms of retail investors that are like non-professional investors like you and I? How do we change the mindset in that set of investors, as well as how do we change mindsets among professional investors that are managing large sums of money? So think about pension funds and you know, big institutional investors. And I'm also looking at doing interviews with these market actors. So that includes everything from issuers of green bonds to investors to governments, regulators, as well as as well as rating agencies, which basically rate how well a green investment is doing. Yeah, okay. Just in time.
Okay, thank you very much, Onsara. Next up, Wesley. Is Wesley here? Here you go.
And four more volunteers.
Hi, good morning, everyone. My name is Wesley Van Weichen. I'm a faculty member in the Department of Geography and Environmental Management. Sorry, I don't have any slides. I just got back from conference. I'm straight here the next day. So my research is really interested in how is climate change impacting Arctic physical environment. And that means permafrost, sea ice, changes in seasonal snow cover, as well as glaciers, and especially how glaciers change and flow and how they'll be modified over the next century. So to do that, I use a lot of remote sensing data. So I'm really interested in using remote sensing data at scale to figure out and really measure and quantify how these different aspects of the physical environment change. And more recently, we've been working with northern communities to see how climate change will actually manifest itself in terms of changing glacier melt and the downstream implications of that related to water availability, as well as mixing within fjords that these catchments drain into. So that's it for me. Thank you very much. Nice to meet you.
Good point. Okay, so basically the idea is that we have three sections to the workshop. Should have said this earlier. The first section are the research pitches. The second one is a more structured interaction where every person will give a brief feedback to the person who has given a pitch and try to find some connection, if you want, with your own research. We'll have those discussions, one hammer, one nail, each roughly 20 minutes, maybe a bit shorter. We'll see how we're on time. And that can evolve into a deeper discussion later on if you want. But the idea is just to have something that builds on these research pitches. One round of interaction. So we'll have groups of roughly three or four people discussing the topic that was presented. One hammer, one nail.
And then after that, so that you have some time to connect with someone who you really thought was interesting, but weren't, you know, assigned to or just chose to give feedback to, you'll have another 45 minutes at the end to go and talk freely with other people. That's the idea. So one more structured interaction, and then at the end, one free 45-minute session.
And just to be clear, these are moving towards potential research projects. So it's not just
if you find there's something substantive to say, yeah. Yes, that's exactly. That's up to you. If you find, oh, that connects with me, then go for it. If you are just curious to find out more, then that's okay too. That's the idea. Okay, who do we have next? Adrian. Adrian also has some art installed downstairs, a 3D installation that you can check out afterwards. Let's have maybe three more volunteers. Vanessa. And there we have two more. Perfect.
So we have a few slides. Can I scroll through them? Okay. So hello, my name is Adrian Mason, and I'm a master's candidate at the University of Waterloo. And my presentation is Art as a Communication Interface for Watershed System Resiliency. Literature review and ecological restoration efforts have shown support for the message that restoring potential for water storage capacity on the landscape and lateral hydrological connectivity could increase watershed system resiliency and even influence patterns of precipitation in small water cycles. The emerging discipline of sociohydrology endeavors to link water management regimes with both the small and large water cycles that make up the global water balance, and further proposes that changing our water management regimes towards restoration could help mitigate aspects of the climate crisis. Over 90% of the water shed in the Pine River is systematically tile drained, meaning that there's a network of buried pipes that dump into the waterways. I worked with the Healthy Lake Huron Working Group and the Pine River Watershed Initiative Network to develop a project focused on the South Pine River headwaters, circled in blue, to hone and enhance restoration techniques given these land use parameters. The flashy nature of the Pine River watershed's hydrograph belies the dominant water management regime in this region, which is to lower the water table and support agricultural practices. Surface water shunted from the agricultural fields not only increases the kinetic rate of flow in the South Pine River watershed, it also carries with it up to 260 metric tons of topsoil during one storm event. 8 water and sediment control basins, also known as WASCOBs, were installed in the South Pine River headwaters to increase the water storage capacity on the landscape to increase watershed system resiliency. The WASCOBs were found by field scale studies conducted by the Assabal Bayfield Conservation Authority as part of the Healthy Lake Huron Working Group to effectively reduce the peak rate of runoff flow leaving the WASCOB areas following a storm event. The series of 8 WASCOBs in the South Pine River watershed restored water storage capacity on the landscape and lateral hydrological connectivity, which corresponded with a reduction in total suspended sediment loads with a p-value of 0.05, which is suggested to be indicative of restoring resiliency by conserving topsoil on the landscape. The Hollings Loop describes a system that is subject to 4 phases: growth, conservation, release, and reorganization. The x-axis of this loop is on a scale of connectivity, the y-axis is on a scale of potential energy, and the z-axis is resiliency. A resilient system is able to move through these 4 phases in the presence of environmental stressors. The Hollings hydrology loops were created in an attempt to incorporate watershed restoration messaging with Hollings loop, showing a resilient and adaptive system and Bernoulli's equation on how water moves in response to changing potential energy in a closed system with uniform pressure. This was done by inserting water into a closed lemniscate loop. Human behavior now affects the functioning of almost every watershed on Earth. If people made informed decisions to act in a restorative way towards local watershed systems, we may be able to influence hydrological feedback loops and with small water cycles and prevent tipping the Earth system's state water balance into an unfavorable regime. Thank you.
Thank you, Adrienne. And really, I encourage you during the refreshment break, lunch, go check out her art. It's really cool. 3D. Next up, Christopher. Let's have three more volunteers. One, two, three. I think you already had a hammer, so one only. Another person? Perfect. Here you go.
Hear me with the microphone?
Yeah, okay. I think it's working. Hi, I'm Christopher Nahanyo. I'm originally a mathematician, but I'm in the systems design engineering department at University of Waterloo. Also, I'm heavily involved with WICI, Waterloo Institute for Complexity and Innovation. I wanted to talk about possibly harnessing complementary currencies for reversing climate change, because as Kirsten told us, we've run off the cliff, so we need to do something urgent, and we may need to do things that are very radical, that are not in line with the usual way of thinking of maximizing exponential profit and so on. We've got one value system in the economics. And my colleague Keith Heipel, who's going to talk soon, has really pointed out the role of values in building systems, different kinds of systems. If you have pathological values on which your systems are based, you often end up with pathological results. You see the examples of that in energy systems and transport, where people have tried to maximize profit, and you have failures of the energy system, electrical systems, or U.S. healthcare, where it's, again, maximizing profit rather than well-being of human beings. And then you have the kind of, although you have so much being spent in the U.S. on healthcare, you have a lower life expectancy than other advanced countries, right? So this idea of value, if we're optimizing for particular values, then we get the kind of results that optimize for those values rather than profit or wealth accumulation or extraction of wealth that tends to go to a very small group. Okay, so we can also design currencies. We know this now very well. We've backed currencies with gold, and we've removed completely any kind of backing for those currencies. It's gone down. You don't even have to have a percent in the bank. The bank doesn't need to keep percent of the value that's deposited. They can just loan out all the money. They're encouraged to pay some interest by the U.S. government paying interest on it to keep some in reserve. Okay, but it's completely gone. And we see the design choices in currency give us a wealth of possibilities. We've seen a very bad example with Bitcoin, which is basically duplicating useless work, so-called proof of work, to do computational hashing with a bunch of leading zeros, and then ends up with burning lots of greenhouse gases and polluting the environment. So it's a disaster for the environment. Other currencies like Sardex on Sardinia are local currencies that are based in excess capacity of the local government, local industries, SMEs, and individuals, and they've been able to make the economic system there robust to extractive capitalism, and also be able to continue their economic activity where they had labor, they had supply and demand, but they couldn't get loans for SMEs. They were able to continue their activity since the 2007 financial crisis by having this complementary currency, which is equal, 1 euro is one Sardex unit. Okay, so there's a lot of talk about carbon trading, carbon and carbon currencies, things like cap and trade, where we're trying to bring the traditional financial instruments to address carbon. Okay, let's say cap and trade is something that shuffles around the right to pollute amongst emitters, and it's not the carbon itself that's valuable. People often confuse that. I've even seen engineers and people who understand this say, "Okay, we've got this. Now we've got this carbon. Let's sell it." Right? And then they pump it into the ground to extract more fossil fuels, for example. Okay, but if we had a complementary currency based on a different kind of unit of value, as a first approximation, sequestering 1 ton of atmospheric CO2, it's important you take the carbon out of the atmosphere and not out of the rainforest or something like that, right? So if you sequester for 100 years 1 ton of carbon, then this could be regarded as generating value. So if your currency is based on sequestration of carbon, you're getting to the 3-minute mark, okay? But you said, try to keep the 3 minutes. All right, so the key is then to remove carbon from the atmosphere. That's what the unit of value should be for us, or other greenhouse gases, in addition to all these complementary activities on stopping emissions, reducing emissions, carbon negative, making the electric vehicle system have the capacity by providing the right energy structure to charge those vehicles in a clean way, and so on. But we're going to be needing to remove 5 to 10 gigatons of CO2 per year by 2050 and 20 gigatons by the 2090s from the air. The US is currently planning to build 4 megaton removal system per year, and that is 0.004 gigatons per year altogether. So that's 250 times below what we need, okay? So we're not going to succeed with these current mechanisms. What we do need to do then is, if we can have a currency that creates value in a way that's similar to quantitative easing, we can avoid the need for these subsidies, avoid the repeal of tax cuts, of tax credits for carbon sequestration and things like that, which can just go up in smoke if the wrong political parties come in. But if we regard carbon sink as the backing for our economy ecological balance, then we can circumvent a lot of the need to have the politicians come on board. Well, we'll need to convince banks, central banks, maybe a global authority, but then there's a design of how do we make such a currency work. And there's a lot of issues to describe and discuss, because we're going to avoid greenwashing, make sure that you're verified and tracked, monitored by blockchain, for instance, and other technologies. So thank you. I'll stop there. Oh, yeah.
Thank you. I guess I'll use the gong rather as a threat and then an end to the talk. So let's see. Next is Yazdan. I'm not sure whether he arrived or not. I saw his badge downstairs. Okay, perhaps he's still stuck in traffic. That means, who is this? Amireza. Perfect. So more on the air pollution side. Can we have 3 more volunteers for Amireza? Okay, Ellie, 2 more. Geoffrey, and 1 more.
More volunteer who doesn't have a meal yet.
Hello, everyone. I'm Amireza. I'm a master's student in the Civil and Environmental Engineering Department. I'm going to be very brief today. First, I want to point out that air pollution is one of the leading risks that ends up, like, leads to premature death right after, like, blood pressure and above alcohol. So it's very important for us to address that, and it's, like, estimated that just in Canada, co-benefits that can rise from dealing and adapting to air pollution can go above $100 billion a year. So my research and our lab, we focus to understand the adaptation behavior and how would that influence co-benefits that we can gain from air pollution. There are lots of uncertainties coupled with this question. For example, it's really, really hard to understand human behavior. There's a book just on this matter called Predictably Irrational that questions the rationality of people with an economical perspective. And also, beside that human leading uncertainties, we have, like, climate variabilities and other things that are changing very fast in our world and will influence how we estimate and understand co-benefits. The very specific part that I am working on is that I'm studying the dynamics that different adaptation behaviors, for example, avoiding air pollution by moving inside the houses, using personal protection equipment such as masks, or improving our houses and buildings, for example, by reducing the infiltration of air inside the building by, like weatherization measures or things like that, and how these will all impact each other, and how much is the costs, the benefits, and how we can provide insights to policymakers to consider air pollution co-benefits in their climate-related policymaking. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Amireza. Next, we'll have our final pure nail, because some people also signed up to present both hammers and nails. Can I get a quick show of hands who has not had a nail yet? Okay, one. Only Lauren? Everyone else? You have not? Okay. Yeah, okay, because we still have some of those both coming, so it's good if we still have a few people left. Next up, that would be Bamis. Lauren, and if you both could give feedback, that'd be great.
Yeah, hi everyone. My name is Aluwa Bamshe, and I'm in my third year for my PhD at the University of Waterloo under Maria Strack. So my research, I'm looking at the carbon dynamics of swamps, I mean cycling of carbon in swamps under a changing climate. And I think this is very important because some of these wetlands or peatlands are kind of wetlands, because I'm sure some of us are not familiar with peatlands. So peatlands are able to store carbon because the rate of carbon assimilation is greater than the rate of carbon loss through decomposition. So over the years, we have a lot of carbon in this ecosystem. But with climate change, we envisage that most of these carbon sinks will actually might turn to sources. So they will create a positive feedback for the climate. So this might actually increase warming in the next couple of years. So ultimately, what my research is trying to do is to understand how climate change would actually impact carbon cycles in swamps in particular. And I think swamps are very important because they store almost 1.1 billion tons of carbon in Southern Ontario alone. So they are very important ecosystems. And to achieve that, you could see a lot of diagrams, arrows everywhere. So it's a model. I'm using the COOP model, which is a one-dimensional process-based model. I'll be forcing it with historical conditions to look at the past and the present. So if our model could somewhat simulate the past and the present, then we could trust it to a certain degree for the future. So in this case, I'll be using the COOP model for that to understand the historic carbon cycle in swamps, and I'll be using a Beverly Swamp in Hamilton as my case study. And we could also see some of the mid-century downscaled future projections. So that'll be some of the climate change scenarios that'll be used to force the model to look at the future. So ultimately, the question that'll be answered with this research will be that, would these ecosystems be a net carbon source or a net carbon sink in the future, even as climate changes? Thank you.
Thank you. So that was the last pure nail, one could say. And now we'll move on to the hammers. Ellie, can you go first, please?
Let's have four people for Ellie. Because, yeah, this is the new round now. One, two, Wesley, three, and John, four.
Hi, my name is Ellie Wolf. I am an associate researcher here at Perimeter. With 3 minutes to give a talk, I figured I would not use a slide and just try to tell you a few stories. So what is causal inference, which is something that I study, and why am I studying causal inference at all? Causal inference is a way of thinking about statistical data when we have multiple variables and we have some statistics over them, and we're trying to disambiguate correlation from causation. We know that correlation does not imply causation, but we know that correlation is usually related to causation, and we're just trying to understand when we can infer causation from correlation. And it's kind of a method of checking our assumptions, checking our hypotheses, and drawing counterfactual conclusions. Some examples. The big one in terms of climate change is, to what extent are humans perhaps causing climate change? I don't think this is a question, which is really open at this stage, but causal inference would be a method by which you could make strong statements there. How do you know that just because carbon is going up and temperatures are going up, that one is causing the other? Perhaps there is some cause which is related to both of them. And if you think it's human activity, how do you prove that? Other examples, there was a study done trying to figure out, is there a miracle food if you would eat this or drink this a lot, you would live a long and healthy life. And so many people were surveyed, their diets were tracked, and they looked to see who's really healthy at the end of a few year cycle. And it turns out that something really stood out. There was something that if you consumed this, you appeared to be significantly healthier, and it was water. People who consumed a lot of water were generally healthier. Does this mean that drinking a lot of water will give you a long life? It turns out that the next highest things was sports drinks. I don't think we're going to say that sports drinks give you a long life, but it would be an evidence that perhaps athletes who are doing a lot of exercise and who are therefore drinking a lot of water are generally healthier than the rest of the population. So in this case, it was exercise, which is explaining why people who were healthy were drinking a lot of water, but it wasn't the water that was causing the health. And this is where we disambiguate correlation and causation. An example that came out of research related to perimeters, there was a student here who, after doing a PhD in quantum foundations, worked for a company that was doing causal analysis in large data, and their particular task was automated medical diagnosis. So you'd put in your symptoms to the computer, and the computer would try to figure out what's wrong with you. Right? This was done in the UK. The UK has had electronic medical records for a long time, so they had tons of data about diseases, their relative prevalence in the population, their symptoms, how they presented, and so all this was used to form a giant database. And then the computer would hear what people were reporting the symptoms and try to diagnose them. And it was quite good. It was at least as good as an average doctor, but not great. And some of the mistakes that this computer system were making were stupid mistakes. If you told it that you were having shortness of breath and chest pain, it would say, oh, with high confidence, diabetes. Problem is, diabetes can't cause either of those two things. Right? Diabetes can cause vision problems, sweating, loss of feeling in the feet, but it can't cause shortness of breath and it can't cause chest pain. What was going on there is diabetes is a comorbidity with obesity. And obesity has lots of heart diseases and sepsis and pulmonary disease, which are related to those symptoms, all of which are rare. So what the computer was answering is, if all I know is that the person has these symptoms, what disease did this person most likely have among all diseases? Not which disease, if cured, would eliminate the symptoms, right? That's a causal question. Now, why is this coming up in quantum foundations? It's because of Bell's theorem, which is a result in quantum theory, which tells us that when we do an analysis of predictions by quantum theory, we know what the relationship between the causal variables should be. And nevertheless, the statistics that emerge are inconsistent with that causal explanation. So we try to like tease this out and say, look, we have evidence for non-classicality because if you validate all your assumptions and you do the causal inference analysis, you reach a contradiction. So where are we going to go with this? We could use this for policy analysis. Does this intervention work? This has been done before in terms of if we do a major advertising blitz around Christmas and we see sales increase, is that because the ads were effective or is it because it's Christmas and people are buying toys? And all of this can be teased out by the methods of causal inference. So I think it could be helpful in analyzing policies and climate models.
Pretty good on time. Thanks, Ellie. I'm overall really excited to have these discussions. So thank you very much, Ellie, for presenting. And next up, I believe we have Freddie. Freddie, can we have actually maybe five people is better since we have fewer nails. Five people for Freddie. One, two, three, four. Five? Great. There we go.
Okay, thank you, Anna. My last name is slightly misspelled, but that's okay. Yeah, so I'm Freddy Cachazzo. So I'm a physicist here at Perimeter Institute working on quantum field theory. So I'm afraid that the hammers I can offer probably don't look very useful, but nevertheless, who knows? Let me try to explain some of them. So, what do we do in quantum field theory? We are trying to combine two of the major scientific breakthroughs in humankind. One of them is quantum mechanics, and the other one is special relativity. we try to put them together and get something that is mathematically meaningful. So as you can expect, this is something that might require tons of mathematical tools and so on. But one of the main challenges is to predict what happens at experiments like the Large Hadron Collider. There we have protons that we accelerate in a 27 kilometer radius accelerator, and we make them smash together. Inside protons, we have quarks, as you all know, but then quarks are not the most likely ones to interact with each other. Actually, the most likely ones to interact with each other are gluons, and the gluons interact. The gluons are particles that keep quarks together, and then they produce tons of other particles. Now, how do you even try to predict or test theories that describe these interactions? Well, we use something that are called Feynman diagrams. And Feynman introduced these diagrams many years ago, and they are a combinatorial nightmare that nobody wants to compute, but everybody has to compute. And over the years, we have been learning that Feynman diagrams actually are very nice because they give us tons of information about the system, but they also are unnecessarily complicated. So the two hammers that I want to propose today, one of them is called redundancies, and the other one is called dualities. And with what we have learned over the years is that by introducing redundancies in the description of your systems, sometimes you think that you're making things more complicated, but sometimes you make them easier for humans to understand. A very simple example is to describe what happens when you divide something by three, say a unit by three. You get a number that looks like 0.3333 with an infinite number of threes, but that's too complicated for humans to actually get a handle on infinity. So we introduce a redundant description like 1/3, which could also be described as 2/6, and so on. So it's redundant because we have many ways of describing that a single object. So that's one of the redundancies we learned when we were kids. And with that, we also use that in quantum field theory to describe these interactions in a simpler way. And dualities is a way to translate one system into another system. So like Penrose, he decided to reform our space-time and have another description where every light ray that you see is described by a single point. And by using a duality, sometimes questions are very hard in one problem, in one system, are very easy to understand in the other. And not surprisingly, not everything is for free. So something that is easy to describe here becomes difficult in the other one. But it doesn't matter because you get to solve problems that were very hard in the original one. Okay? Thank you.
Okay, maybe I should lift it up before hitting it.
Yeah, you did it work.
Yes. Well, thank you, Freddie. That's actually very cool. You know, I didn't know what everyone was going to present, but this idea of simplifying through math was certainly an idea that came up at the previous workshop. So maybe we can dig a little deeper into that. Thank you. Next up, we have Kevin. So let's have maybe three people in person, and we want to add in the people from online. So are there two people online, perhaps, who would like to give feedback for Kevin? I see, Christopher, you've got your laptop open, or maybe I can also check quickly. Let me check my laptop. Let's put it this way. Let's have four people, and if there are people online, then, you know, feel free to join groups as you wish afterwards. So who wants to go with Kevin? Adrian? Mino? Three? Four. Perfect.
Okay, thank you. So my name is Kevin Costello. My research is actually really pretty close to Freddie's. He even mentioned things I've been working on with this Penrose stuff. So I won't take up too much of your time. I feel like personally, you know, I'm really here to learn from the experts on climate change. I'm not going to say knowledge of quantum field theory is going to solve all kinds of problems, because I think your problems that you're studying are very hard. So like Freddie, I work on the mathematics of quantum field theory. So Freddie explained how, you know, one way to interpret quantum field theory is we're studying these things in the Large Hadron Collider and scattering quarks off each other and so on. And of course, this is the way is probably most investigated, but actually there's another way to start to think about quantum field theory. It has the same mathematics, but the interpretation is different, which is that it's the same thing as statistical mechanics, which is a very familiar thing. So for instance, I like to study models of quantum field theory, which are integrable. Mostly quantum field theory is super hard and you put it on a big computer or something and you find approximate answers. But occasionally there are these magical systems which you can solve exactly by hand, pen and paper. So my favorite systems has two interpretations. One is it's a wire, and on this wire, there's a bunch of atoms which are interacting with each other. It's called the Heisenberg spin chain. This is all kind of quantum woo-woo fancy stuff. But the other interpretation developed by mathematicians is something totally familiar. They were like, I want to model the statistical mechanics of ice. Ice is a lattice, hexagonal lattice. Each atom is vibrating. It's a very classical thing. What happens? And they found that even though it's this big complicated lattice and each thing is interacting with each other, they found something completely solvable. My research is all about these exactly solvable special quantum systems. Okay, so that's...
Oh, thank you, Kevin. And I see Mino's already getting up. I think you will probably have very interesting conversations with the people from Wiki. Do we have someone from Wiki who wants to give feedback? Okay. You already? Vanessa, how about you? Okay. Francis, you as well? Amireza and Miranda? Okay.
I'm Meenu Kumari, a postdoc here. So my research is in the field of classical and quantum chaos, dynamical systems theory and bifurcation theory in some way. So like weather is predominantly chaotic. So like, have you ever thought why can't we predict weather a few months in advance? Like we can't really say what's the weather going to be like here. On 1st September, right? So have you ever thought, why can't we do that? So this is because weather is chaotic. But we can roughly say, okay, if it is September, how the weather is going to be like, approximately what are the bounds? So that is like climate in a way, that on a long time scale, what is the variability? So the question is, as time is changing, climate is changing now. So weather is chaotic, and I have studied a lot about chaos and dynamical systems theory. And how can we use this knowledge that weather system is chaotic to understand long-term fluctuations in climate, like how climate changes, and then use that knowledge to do something, such that we can control those fluctuations in a way that climate change is controlled. So like that is a big picture in a way. So like I have worked in dynamical systems theory in my undergrad and a bit. So in dynamical systems, like bifurcations, a lot, if you have a system, you can model it and there are bifurcations in the system, like as you change the parameters in the system, how things change. So chaos was discovered by a meteorologist, Edward Lorange, in 1963. He came up with this phenomenon. Initially, he had modeled weather system using a 12 system of equation, but eventually he reduced it to just three degree of freedom system. So there's three differential equations. And if you just try to study a three variable differential equation, it is so complex in a way. So it is very interesting to understand like how these complexity arise in just such a small system and what it can do to larger systems. Like the way we model system weather is is in a way a large complex system, but even such smaller systems can have such complex dynamics. So how we can use that to understand like this complex versus simple system. Chaos is a property of simple system as well. It's not just a property of complex system. So yeah.
Thank you, Mina. In your case, perhaps the connection is slightly easier to make than with quantum field theory. Next up, we have Geoffrey. I saw you had slides that also had videos. So perhaps, Kirsten, if you could just use your laptop to open that up. I don't want to break anything. In the Google Drive.
There's the yellow one.
This one.
Is there anything else I should open that?
It's only this one.
Okay. Is this close enough that we can take from here?
Yeah,
maybe we can make just slide show back.
I guess you get one video.
Okay, cool.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. My name is Geoffrey Ryan. I'm a postdoc here. I'm in the strong gravity group, and I do computational astrophysics, a variety of things, but most of them involve, in some ways, computational fluid dynamics. This, of course, is already very important for climate modeling at all sorts of scales. You know, we have global models to study the atmosphere and oceans. Small scale work, people who are really interested in wind turbines, for instance, have to do a lot of fluid dynamics to design their turbines, design the placement of wind farms, et cetera, et cetera. Here at PI, we have a lot of expertise and experimentation with fluid dynamics, new techniques, new codes. My workhorse is this code called DISCO. We really like using moving meshes to do things. Doesn't really show the moving mesh too well, but we sort of have our grid cells sort of shear past each other. This allows us to do sort of solve these problems sort of more efficiently with more accuracy, reduces numerical diffusion a lot. I typically use it to study accretion disks, things like these orbiting black holes with gas and stuff falling on them. This guy was supposed to be a very pretty Kelvin-Helmholtz wave that you can't see right now, but we can all simulate more mundane things like this thing up here. The same equations that sort of govern all these systems in space that we study sort of govern fluids here on Earth, air and water and all that sort of stuff. And would be happy to chat if there are applications, fluid dynamics, et cetera.
Well, thank you, Geoffrey. Also, in reverse, I think we forgot the five people for Geoffrey. Who wants to go? Give him feedback later. Okay, Lauren, one.
Need
a few more. How many people did not? Okay, Freddie, sure. And let's have one third person. Has everyone already had?
Okay, well then we have to switch it up
a little. Let's say Amireza, can you switch perhaps to Geoffrey?
Give him feedback.
The previous topic was
yeah. Okay, perfect, Mackenzie. That's good. And next up we have Keith. Keith is online. Can you hear us, Keith?
Yes, I can hear you. Thank you. Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Let's go back.
Okay, then just let me know when I should click next on your slides.
Okay, so I'm going to speak about the GRAP model for conflict resolution. Okay, next slide, please. So climate, of course, involves a lot of conflict. Climate and climate change is a global phenomenon, and it affects different stakeholders having conflicting value systems involving both competition and cooperation. And also we even have serious disputes over which mitigation adaptation approaches to climate change to adopt. So is there some way that we can somehow model these conflicts in order to come up with solutions that satisfy as much as possible the value systems of the various stakeholders? Next, please. So my original field of research, I worked in water resources management and stochastic hydrology. And then we found that in water resources and environmental problems, there are a lot of controversies, and there simply were not good approaches available to model conflict. The approaches didn't have very good assumptions underlying them. They could not be applied to these real world conflicts. So my colleague, students, and I, over three decades, we developed something called the graph model for conflict resolution, which can be applied to a wide variety of disputes. Okay, next, please. So I just wanted to point out in this slide that it's very important to consider both the societal aspects and physical systems or environmental natural systems of real world problems. So my presentation, of course, is more on the left today. Conflict resolution has most applications in the societal systems area on the left, but I think are very important. We want to make sure that we understand the physical and environmental systems well. So we have these interrelated societal and environmental systems of systems. Next, please. So I think the name of the game here is we want to determine the key characteristics of real world problems. And then maybe we can come up with a toolbox of hammers or models that have the capabilities to reflect these key characteristics. So it's very important to have a good toolbox of hammers available. And then on the lower part of the slide here, I think it's crucial that we make these available for application in the real world through decision support systems. Make sure they can be computerized and easily employed by people who are looking at tough, let's say, climate and climate change models in this case. Okay, next, please. I guess we have it there. So developing a decision. So we want any decision model, or for that matter, physical systems model too, to reflect reliability. And then we can improve it by testing and experimentation. And the model should be very solid mathematically and parsimonious. And then to apply it within a decision support systems, we often need very good, sophisticated math implementation algorithms. So there's another location there where the role of mathematicians are very important. Maybe I should be calling the people mathematical engineers, because what you really are doing are trying to use mathematics to solve problems. In this case, very important problems. Okay, the next one, please. Now this screen here shows an ideal design of decision support system for the graph model for conflict resolution. So we have an input subsystem where we have to know who are the key decision makers, what are the options or courses of actions available, and what are their underlying value systems and related preferences with respect to the conflict being analyzed. And then we have an analysis engine where we actually look at conflict like a chess game, moves and counter moves, and we have different models of human behavior under conflict, which we call stability definitions or solution concepts, as the decision makers jockey with one another for position, attempt to do as well as possible. And then when we come up with some sort of new characteristic, we want to be able to model that mathematically and then eventually add that to decision support system. So for example, we might have misperceptions, or we may have uncertainty of options, of preferences, and we might be able to model that using probability theory or fuzzy sets and gray numbers or some sort of mathematical approach. Once again, these different aspects of conflict being as much as possible mathematically modeled. Again, in the final slide, please. So I'm a member of CGS. I'm very interested in governance. How do we actually implement this so society can benefit and nature too? I think a good idea, a number of people mentioned the whole idea of systems, have some sort of system of systems perspective. We want it to be integrative. That in that sense, involve both the societal and environmental systems. And here by adaptive, we mean if a policy isn't working and meeting the goal, then you adapt or change the policy to try to meet it. And then somehow participatory, so it reflects the value systems of stakeholders. So I like the comment that Christopher made earlier in his carbon currency. You have wired right into the approach he's developing there, the proper values for, let's say, combating climate change. Of course, we want to make sure that we reduce the overall quantity of carbon in the atmosphere, make the carbon cycle be operating more properly by not having too much carbon in the atmosphere. So I really like the idea of this conference here and congratulate the organizers. I think it's nice to take a look at the different mathematical approaches that are available on the shelf. And maybe given the characteristics of these methods, they can capture some of the key characteristics that we find in climate, and we can use these tools together to try to solve these very difficult problems for society and nature. So I encourage all of you to keep working on these important problems and be highly motivated. So nice to see such a large number of talented students and professors here talking about their research. It's nice to see the passion that they have. So keep up
okay.
The work.
And cool.
Really tough problems out there that hopefully all of us can somehow contribute to solving. So I think I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Keith. Heard you very well. So we'll look forward to having a conversation with you afterwards. I'm thinking perhaps if Martin, I believe Martin's online as well. If you would like to pair up with Keith later, that would be perfect.
Sure.
Great. Okay, next we'll move to those people who signed up as presenting both hammers and nails. Mae Francis, I thought we'd put you in the hammers section. So is there anyone, I believe you weren't here in the beginning, perhaps to recap, we'll just be having 2x20-minute discussion sessions after the pitches where you give feedback and keep talking about the topics that were presented here. So if perhaps you will go with Francis afterwards, that'd be great.
And I'm not sure whether this mic is actually working. Is it doing something? Okay, so I'll use it then.
Yes.
Okay, so hello everyone. My name is Francis Poulet. I'm a professor in applied mathematics at Waterloo, also cross-appointed in physics. A lot of the nails I focus on are in classical physics, so not the really small or the really fast. Being in applied mathematics, I guess I have a large collection of hammers and nails that I like to investigate. 3 minutes for both. Okay. In terms of the nails category, so the areas that I tend to work on are large-scale ocean currents and eddies. I also study planktonic ecosystems in the ocean, and for fun, do a bit of solar physics. But the particular nail that I'll talk about today is, I guess, one, the ocean current we talk most about around here would be the Gulf Stream, and it receives lots of media attention. What's happening with the Gulf Stream? Big question, is the Gulf Stream going to stop? Short answer, no. As long as the winds blow and the earth turns, the Gulf Stream will flow. However, the speed at which it flows and how much water it transports across the ocean does change in time. And understanding that gives us a lot of insight into changing climate. So this is something that I'm studying right now with a student, which I think is very important. In the minute that I have left or so, in terms of the hammers, so my general philosophy being in applied mathematics is to describe the world, whether it's physics, biology, social, economics, whatever you want, in the language of calculus, using rates of change, for example. Newton's second law is an excellent example, which tells us the rate of change of the momentum is the sum of the forces. So if you tell me the forces, I can hopefully determine what the momentum is going to be, whether it's for a particle or whether it's for a fluid system. These are the things that we do, which we usually do computationally because of the fact that the equations tend to be very hard. But any sort of system you want, one of the hardest parts is figuring out how to write down the equations. Physics is easier in a sense because we have Newton's second law. In biology, there's no equivalent of that. I can write down any sort of equation I want, and it's really hard to justify whether this is the right model to use. So a lot of thought needs to be put into that. But then the second part of it is when you have your model, which hopefully you believe, you want to learn from it, you want to justify it. Solving it using a variety of computational tools that are available to you is something that we do. It reduces down to linear algebra, essentially, which is great. The more computing power we have, the more problems we can solve precisely using CPUs, GPUs, threaded computing, parallel computing, whatever you want. There's all sorts of tools, but it's always good to know the model you want to study is meaningful in some way, and hopefully you can learn something from that. And I'll stop there. Sorry if I went on for too long.
Okay, now we have our final four presentations. And since we have a few less participants online, I'm not sure how well they're going to be part of the next discussion. So we have two people from Kirsten going to the next speaker, which will be Dr. Dow. So who went with Kirsten? Am I seeing that? One, two more people that we have. Four members who went with Kirsten.
All right, thanks so much. Okay, so I'm coming here from the Department of Geography and Environmental Management. I'm also cross-appointed with Applied Mathematics at the University of Waterloo. What I look at is water flow under glaciers and ice sheets. So in order to do this, we're applying finite element models that are looking at both efficient systems and inefficient systems. So when we're talking about efficient systems, these are channels that are growing underneath the ice, moving water all the way from inland right out to the oceans. We also have inefficient systems that are more tortuous, slowly moving water. And both of these are very, very important in different ways. And these are the nails of this presentation. So the inefficient systems pressurize underneath the ice. And the more pressurized and spread out these systems are, the faster your ice flows. The faster your ice flows, the more sea level rise you have. The channels are pumping fresh water all the way from the inland right into the ocean. And where the ice begins to float in the ocean is called the grounding line, which is a very, very sensitive region. And what we've been discovering in our research is that the fresh water pumping into the ocean over this grounding line is causing enhanced melt. And that's a particularly big problem for the Antarctic, because in these regions, this is where ice can destabilize very, very rapidly, moving inland and adding meters and meters to sea level rise. So up until now, really, we've only been applying the hydrology model on its own. But at the moment, we're coupling this with, or we're beginning to couple it with an ice dynamics model called the ice sheet and sea level system model. And this is very important because it's all very well saying, okay, the hydrology is having this important dynamic impact, but until we can get the feedbacks from the ice dynamics model itself, we're really unable to project into the future. And this is a huge problem that the IPCC has at the moment, is that all of the projections from ice sheet models are not including any hydrology. They're using Bessel parameterizations that are essentially lumped in errors from anything that's happening within the ice, at the bed, not including temporal change. And so if we're going to really predict how much sea level rise, we have to have this hydrology input into the ice dynamics model. It's not an easy thing to do. There are a lot of instabilities that we're encountering. And so this is going to be our big challenge over the next probably 5 years to try and get this. Now, when you look at the projections from these ice dynamics models, they're ranging from 1 meter of sea level rise in the next 100 years up to 12 meters. This is a huge, huge range. We really need to pin this down if we're going to accurately mitigate against these problems. So one thing, for example, we're discovering is that the models with a really, really high output of sea level rise are being tuned with perhaps unreasonable physics. It's called the marine ice cliff instability. And they're having to do this because if you're trying to match paleo models with paleo real paleo data that's being collected, you cannot get the rate of retreat just using ice dynamics. However, because they haven't included hydrology, we're wondering whether that is the missing link. If we start adding hydrology in, can we have these models not require less realistic physics, like ice cliff instability? And perhaps because of the feedbacks with hydrology, maybe we won't be looking at 12 meters of sea level rise. This is something we really, really need to pin down. And so we're hoping that our work over the next few years will be able to do that. All right, thank you so much.
Perfect, thanks, Christine. Three more to go. I think next up is Don. Could I see who went with Vasundhara before giving feedback? Okay, people seem to be remembering well. Maybe we'll end up just giving spontaneous feedback in the end. Okay.
Hi, thanks a lot. Should I go over here so I can press return? Okay,
if that's, good
that's fine. So this work is with the RISE team funded by Environment and Climate Change Canada, and you can read more about the project there. So the NAIL is the challenge of improving blue-green infrastructure in cities, especially on residential lands, which make up the majority of lands within cities. Also called GI, sorry if that has other meanings, but and natural assets. So I said trees, but they include trees, other kinds of landscaping, natural wetlands on the bottom, that's my rain garden. So I would say that the hammer here is the complex systems viewpoint and how that justifies our hopes that better information will improve this system. So this green infrastructure on private lands is a public-private values challenge. And I had some slides from a Fields Institute about public goods and private goods. So GI has the offsite mitigation, adaptation, and co-benefits of public values, soaking up stormwater, sequestering carbon, reducing heat island impacts, improving air quality when we have smoke events, fostering biodiversity. But the private benefits tend to be much lower, which means that markets and individuals will underprovide. Maybe you get reduced cooling costs, reduced flood risks, aesthetic benefits. We've done research that shows maybe 3-6% premium in private values. So there's a disconnect both in within cities and also between cities and the global environment. So we, through other research, I'm saying we, and this was also done with Derek Robinson and our great team in the US, also other work here, that developers are key because they establish the social norms about landscaping. The primary determinant of what someone will do with their private yard is what their neighbors are doing. So the point here is that social norms, conformity, and reciprocity norms dominate, but developers are also highly status seeking. When they do their landscaping, they tend to take a short run view. They lock in a landscaping style that will be maintained. So there's a high degree of path dependence. We're the RISE team is doing this amazing project, Go Team UW, where we're doing pre-development, ideally parcel inventories of GI and estimates of its function in terms of temporal trajectories of stormwater and carbon management, asking whether better public information will increase developers' motivation to create and maintain GI and new developments. That's my rain garden in production. So the idea here is that you might have a forest to subdivision site like one happening all over our cities where the temporal trajectory of carbon sequestration will never catch up to what it would have been if nothing were done. Alternatively, farm fields to subdivisions on the carbon side have tremendous potential. We want to work with developers to rearrange their site plans, bring in more green infrastructure using these public information metrics to improve that carbon and stormwater profile. So I won't spend a lot of time here, but there are many places where this information metric is hoped to leverage different behavior, both from developers, planners, and in the public realm, residents, nonprofits, and within the real estate market. So we're hoping that this will shift incentives, not necessarily solve all of the public good aspects, but leverage status-seeking behavior and social norms, improve the time horizon and the quality of evidence-based conversation around these decisions. I'm looking for a master's student. I'm looking for anybody who's interested in working on this project. We have tremendous flexibility about who we hire and what they're doing. We're also looking for a postdoc with integrated modeling, complex system sensitivity analysis. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Don. Two more to go. Next up, Vanessa. And I think we'll just go for being a bit more flexible afterwards with the discussion sessions, since we have such good retention of groups.
Right, I'm just finding where the microphone is. So hi, I'm Vanessa Schweitzer. I am a professor in the Department of Knowledge Integration at the University of Waterloo, also connected to the Waterloo Institute for Complexity Innovation, as well as a faculty member at the Balsillie School of International Affairs. And this picture is actually a picture of natural / physical tipping points in the climate system, where Lenten and colleagues have been working on this topic for a while. I also was very pleased to see that Timothy Lenten, who's at the University of Exeter, recently hosted a meeting where he's trying to bring together natural and physical scientists as well as social scientists to be thinking about tipping points. What I was surprised to see, because I was a remote participant, but what I was surprised to see at that meeting was that these communities were actually not on the same page. There is a concern about natural and physical climate tipping points. And as you can see from that picture, if you don't have a background in this topic, what the physical and natural scientists are concerned about are that you can see within the geophysics that there are these teleconnections between different parts of the climate system. And as we see things like Arctic ice melting, sea levels possibly rising, et cetera, there are these concerns about how these are going to be impacting people and ecosystems that are spread out throughout the planet. So what surprised me was that the scientists who are looking at the geophysics and are then also asking the question of how might we be bringing some of the ways that we understand this system to society and thinking about societal tipping points. My own background, my PhD is in engineering and public policy. I also have a master's in environmental studies and my bachelor's, I actually did study physics, minored in mathematics as well. So I'm very open to the idea that mathematics and science can actually be applied to social systems to inform this question. But not everybody sees it that way, which I was surprised about. I actually work with a particular methodology that does try to look at very high-level descriptions of societies, or maybe even cultures, we could say. We know that there's a lot of diversity in human cultures. Over 3,800 have been documented by anthropologists. And these different expressions of culture we could actually say that there are certain variables that influence those expressions. What I am interested in for a research topic is how might we use some of the similar physical and mathematical tools that we use to understand natural and physical systems to look at things like these different basins of attraction, how the landscape, the stability landscape, if you will, of different cultures in light of the fact that the physical geography is changing, how is that going to start putting pressure on social systems? And how might we be able to anticipate these changes to try to avert crises through using tools of anticipation? So I use a particular approach, which is called cross-impact balances analysis. I'm happy to tell anyone more to go deep in the weeds on this, but in general, to kind of hook other mathematics and physics people into perhaps getting involved with this. The methodology combines network analysis, ordinary differential equations, and then there are some limits to my knowledge because I primarily studied mathematics up through like the undergraduate level. So the person who developed this methodology also talks about things like Kaufman nets, where I don't quite know what those are, but I want to learn about them. Anyways, the kinds of outputs that you get from this particular methodology is an adjacency matrix, as well as coordinates for different attractors that are in a state space that you define, as well as the trajectories for any point that is outside of an attractor. There have been some elaborations on this method, namely simulated annealing, and then I also was a lead author on a paper about Markov chains where I was learning a lot, but I also still have so much more to learn. So a big challenge in doing this research is that it's really at the extreme limit of understanding. We need to have teams that are willing to work in multidisciplinary ways and also honor that they might be kind of getting you know, in over their head with respect to like me as someone where I kind of feel like I have been spending more time with social scientists than mathematicians lately. So sometimes I'm in over my head when I'm trying to follow the mathematics. It's, I guess, the kind of research that I want to do is to also reach out to the social scientists who are a bit skeptical of this idea of using natural and physical, using mathematical tools to try to inform how we understand a change in social systems. And so there would be a learning curve for doing this kind of work. I presumably will also have copies of slides that are available to people. So if anybody is curious and wants to look at the various papers that inform these slides, this is an invitation, and I'm also happy to meet you today. Thank you.
Cool. Thank you, Vanessa. And for sure, the slides will be sent around, so feel free to read any of these references that Vanessa put. And finally, Martin, we already tested that, so I think you can hear us. We can hear you.
Yes. Okay. Great. So I'm a physicist, and I've been involved at Perimeter for almost 20 years on an informal basis. Prior to that, I worked in industry. I worked in IT and information security. And for 17 years prior to that, I worked in research for Ontario Hydro on all kinds of different aspects of the power system. Near the start of the pandemic, I started thinking about how I would make our own house more energy efficient. And then I started doing a lot of research. And I discovered that, well, it's very difficult for an individual to make their house energy efficient. Not difficult in the sense of it's not possible to do, but it's very difficult to find the people to do it for you, to find the materials, and it's also very expensive. We have in Canada a public policy that says, and not just Canada, it's wider than this, public policy that says we should make our buildings more efficient, and then we should electrify everything. We should heat with heat pumps instead of gas furnaces and so on. And I've looked at this pretty intensely and come to the conclusion, along with a number of colleagues, that this is simply not feasible. And there are others who agree. I spoke a week ago with a very senior person in the real estate industry who agrees completely. This is not something that's going to happen, but the problem is that public policy is not pointing in the right direction. But from the investment side, they're not interested in trying to change public policy. They just want to make money. And so, you know, this is a frustration. But we see public policy being played by biases, misinformation, and wishful thinking. And when you write to them or talk with them to try and change that, they kind of sort of acknowledge that, yes, maybe you're right, but we're doing this anyways. So there are lots of misconceptions. One is that hydroelectric power is clean. There have been studies done for the major power projects in Northern Quebec that indicate that the GHG emissions due to these projects, due to flooding and modifying the ecosystem, the net result is they produce in the long run about half as much greenhouse gases as burning natural gas. So it's not clean. Others say we should be using biofuels. We just need to use lots of biofuels. The Canadian gas industry says we could replace half of our natural gas with biofuels. you look at the basic numbers in terms of the efficiency and the long term, photosynthesis is so inefficient that you could at best replace about 3% of the natural gas we use with biofuels. Ultimately, the energy has to come from the sun and it has to be converted by photosynthesis, and there's no way around this. Hydrogen is another major theme, and lots of people say we should be using hydrogen. In Ontario, the IESO, the Independent Electricity System Operator, is saying we're going to have 15 gigawatts of natural gas fired, and that's natural gas, hydrogen fired generation by 2050. But how that hydrogen will be produced is an unknown. If it's produced from natural gas, you actually have more greenhouse gases emitted than if you just burn the natural gas to start with. So and it's a very inefficient process if you go through electrolysis to produce hydrogen to then burn that again to produce electricity. So the major theme that we're focused on, and I worked with, founded the Boltzmann Institute with some colleagues, is that we need to start making use of thermal energy that we're throwing away today. So if you take the Pickering and Darlington nuclear stations on Lake Ontario, well, they throw more heat into enough heat into Lake Ontario to heat 80% of the buildings in all of Ontario. And if you put other power stations, you're going to get up over 100%. And if you use that heat, which otherwise is just thrown away, then you can stop burning all the natural gas. So it's a much more efficient process to use the heat that we otherwise throw away than it is to produce electricity or to burn natural gas to produce heat. The final bullet there is that seasonal thermal energy storage is something we need to do. You can store heat from year to year, just in the ground or in large bits of water, quite inexpensively. There's all kinds of effort to do major battery storage, but it's unaffordable, and you're only getting 4 to 12 hour storage from that. So the real challenge we're facing is that we need policies to be much better informed. We need analysis for policies that's not just going to look at the mathematical, the physical, or the chemical aspects of this, but we need to look at the economics, the technology, the industrial capacity, the workforce, the feasibility, the timelines, and so on. We have to put all that together to come up with policy that's going to be meaningful. And at this point, I'm really challenged, or we're challenged, by trying to influence decision makers who are following a pattern that they've been following for years, and they're unwilling to change direction. So that's the challenge I'm looking at. Thank you.
Thank you, Martin. And with that, we've pretty much concluded our first part of the workshop. This was certainly the most fast-paced part, and I hope you now all have a rough idea of who's in the room, who works on what, who would like to discuss what for the rest of today.